Down the kitchen talks about food. Donald on the kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. Thank you for joining us today. Well, we've got a new year, and we're looking forward to KHOI Radio being in a brand new house real soon. Matter of fact, there's boxes being moved and things being stacked away and taken care of. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. We're looking forward to KHOI being in its new home real soon.
It's only two blocks from the old home. So
couldn't it be better? It's just really nice. I'm looking forward to it, and everyone else is too. Well, we sort of had a little blast of winter, and today it's not so bad winter. It's the sunshine outside, and we can deal with winter like this. This is okay. I'm starting, of course, I'm sure a lot of people are, getting seed catalogs now. Matter of fact, I've got a whole big stack of seed catalogs.
Yes, the armchair gardening season is upon us.
Oh, it is. It is time to order things. Actually, I've been getting seed catalogs long about Thanksgiving. They're pushing it. But it's time for thoughts of spring gardening. And one thing I've noticed is, well, of course, prices are going up as seeds are getting more expensive, as they should. It's amazing what we ask those little seeds to do and what they do. They are little miracles. So the fact that they cost us a little something, that's not so bad. But anyway.
Well, have you made your list of tomato varieties? I'm waiting for the announcement of how many varieties is Lana going to plant next summer.
No, I haven't made my list. I'm still dreaming. I'm still flipping through things and going online. And anyway, but just wanted to let you know that, yes, I am thinking of the spring garden. Yes, I am. Well, thanks for joining us today around our kitchen table. Today on the Donald on the Kitchen, we're going to be considering food labels and meat prices, and I've got a black-eyed peas recipe I'd like to share, and some news items that are gathered by our Donald on the Kitchen news department. We've got those things to share, too. So let's get to it. Food labels. It's hard to keep up with what's new. And, Donna, didn't you run across a bit of fact there that said that reading labels takes four times as long in the grocery store as it used to?
If you bother.
They are four times as long, and there's more interesting stuff. So, Donna, what's new?
Well, there were two food stories this week in the news, and the first one is with January 1st. The new federal GMO label went into effect, basically. Now, this has been a long time coming, and in fact, it is no longer called GMOs. It is now called bioengineered.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm just going to cross out this GMO thing here.
Right.
Bioengineered.
So that was a little switcheroo that the feds, were encouraged to make, and I personally think it was a kind of an something to obfuscate what they were really trying to do, because people are used to saying GMO, but no, we're going to use the word bioengineered. So, translation, it's the new GMO. The history of this label, because this is making a federal label takes a long time. This has been a contentious thing for a long time because, the foodie advocates thought it was important to have a label so that people could at least know what they were eating, right? So they started to do it state by state, and in Vermont it started in 2013. There were issues on ballots of whether we were going to do it. And they, in Vermont, they finally passed it so that it was going to go into effect on July in 2016. Now, there were other states, like up in the Pacific Northwest and stuff, and then, and a large amount of money was spent to counter it, especially by the Grocery Manufacturers Association and, you know, the basically conventional powers that be. They really didn't want to deal with this. So, but when they could see that the electorate was determined state by state to get some of this through, they went, oh, all right, let's do a preemptive federal label, right? So at least it's the same everywhere, because you can imagine if you have to label your national brand of cereal specifically for Vermont, you might as well just go in and do the whole hog. So the feds hauled this up and started working on a label. And, you know, frankly, when it's now finally come out and we see what we get, and really by this point hardly anyone cares, they have not made it easy for consumers. The idea is, you know, the studies, there's a Cornell University study that says GMO is likely not to impact purchasing decisions. That's the latest news. And because, first of all, they've put it, you can put it in print on the label, but you can also, if your company wants to just put a QR code on it where you have to call them up and find out what's in it, this is not like you just go and read the can in the supermarket. You have to have a smartphone, you have to have internet connection, and then you can figure out. And they've also put a lot of loopholes. And so some of the loopholes are that highly refined ingredients, whatever that means to them, do not have to be labeled, or what they're calling a non-detectable level of GMO. So they think
non-detectable,
it's, you know, too small.
Huh?
Also, meat and poultry do not have to be labeled. So if the cows ate GMO, which most cows do at this point, and, of course, chickens as well, they don't have to tell you that. It does not have to be labeled. Also, foods at restaurants do not have to be labeled. Now, so here's the, and this has been true for years, folks. Basically, if you buy something that has a USDA organic label on it, it will not have GMOs in it.
Ha!
Or it will have, even within the organic label at this point, there's so much GMO contamination in crops and, you know, like especially with soy and canola and stuff like that. So even the organic label has something, a very, I've forgotten, it's 0.0 something. If it's below that level, it can have an organic label. There's also the non-GMO label, which was on a lot, you know, the little butterfly thing. Since 2010, that is actually a more stringent label than the federal label. So you can still rely on those two labels to get you the information that you need. And here's something else you need to know. These are the plants that have been developed to have GMOs in them. Some apples. Mm-hmm. Not most of them, but there's a couple, like the one that doesn't turn brown, for example. Corn, which is ubiquitous, and soybeans, obviously, and eggplants, papaya, pineapple, potatoes, and recently they've put a farmed salmon on the market.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Finally, that one has made it. That's been very, very controversial. So if it doesn't, you know, if you're buying your normal fruits and vegetables, so like at the farmer's market, probably you're okay. Although, even in the Ames farmer's market, some of the corn on the cob is grown with genetically modified corn.
Yeah,
it is not easy to find out. You can ask the farmer. Some of them don't know, mm-hmm. like some of our corn stands around town, particularly because it's not the farmer. It's somebody they've hired to man the stand. And I have for several years been asking, and either they don't know or they want not to know. So,
you're the customer that when they see you coming, they go, "Uh-oh, she's going to ask."
Well, when I ask, there's a lot of sometimes like blank stare or shuffling around or, "Gee, I really don't know." And sometimes they know and they'll tell you, you know. But those that's the the most obvious one. I mean, we don't have papayas and pineapples in the farmers. Now, potatoes, I need to look into that more. That's certainly not a lot of potatoes. Maybe some of the commercials grown ones that they're doing
would that
for French
be in
fries
the,
nationally. Or
no, no, not in the processing of potatoes. Was what do you do with potatoes? You cut them up for French fries.
Right.
Or mush them up. No, huh? Well, potatoes are a big, see, anything that's got a possibility of making lots of money, I suppose.
Well, it's a big they have managed not to GMO rice, even though there's been attempts at that.
Uh-huh.
And they've kept that out of the market. You know, most grains, wheat has not been GMO'd or bioengineered, excuse me. Now, there is another thing that's going on that I need to look a little, do a little more research, but the latest technique for modification is called CRISPR.
Oh, I've heard of CRISPR.
Yeah. And some of the products that have been CRISPR'd are now flying. They're not considered genetically modified. They're CRISPR'd or something.
Whoa.
So that's another dodgy bit that we'll have to keep an eye on. I do want to tell this story. This comes from Lynn Clarkson, who is a very big Midwest grain dealer. He buys, like, you know, barges of soybeans and corns and ships them all over the world. And he's from Illinois. And a lot of his work, he really specializes, not entirely, but he specializes in organic grains and non-GMO grains. So he really keeps his ear to the ground on this one. So he's in Illinois. So this stuff goes down the Mississippi, a lot of it, right? So Lynn Clarkson told me this story, I don't know, 5 or more years ago. He had a delegation from the Japanese trade, whatever, come to see his facility, you know, and make sure it was all up to snuff because Japan imports a lot of non-GMO soy for their product, you know, their tofu and whatever, you know, they eat. And so the delegation was visiting him, and the highest diplomat said to Lynn, he said, "Listen, I've been invited by Monsanto to tour their plant in St. Louis." This is when there was Monsanto. It's now Bayer. So he said, he asked if he could tag along. So Lynn went with the Japanese trade delegation just to see what it was like. And so the Japanese gentleman has had the big royal tour of Monsanto, and he goes, "Well, this is really, really impressive. Of course, I think it's a very a marvelous thing that's going on here. But call me in 30 years, you know, after this has been market tested on humans for 30 years, then we will eat this stuff in Japan if there's no problems." Right. So obviously we in the United States are the guinea pigs.
We seem to have a lower threshold, as
yeah,
they say.
Yeah, yeah. They're practicing the do no harm mantra. So good for them. So that's a true story about some people that don't want to eat GMOs.
And here we are. We're talking about labeling. We haven't even backed up. We're still finding out if this stuff is good for us or not, or what is it doing to us?
Well, and it's basically, let's hide this from the consumer as much as we possibly can, so that even should you want to make your own decisions, you really have trouble finding the information.
That's true.
So the federal bioengineered label has been released. It's kind of a bust. The commercial manufacturers really got what they wanted out of it, so that it's really not convenient for consumers, doesn't really give much information, and it's a done deal. So there you go. I guess it brings us back to the organic label or the non-GMO label is all the assurance that you're going to get. Or you can grow it yourself.
Sounds like we have more to read in the grocery store.
Well, now when you get the seed catalogs,
yeah.
Do they tell you if the seeds have been bioengineered?
Yes. Yeah. The seed catalog. Well, not all seed catalogs, but yes, the seed catalogs.
So it's not. They're not required to say that.
No. But there are a lot of growers that really care, and there are. Yes, these are not treated with this and that. They are not bioengineered. Yeah, you can look for that. Something else to look for. Mm-hmm, so yes, mm-hmm. and
so it's still up to the consumer to track it down and figure it out.
Yes, it is. Well. That's one thing to talk about, the labels and what we see on our food. Just it's not food anymore. It's food, but then you have to read the label. But we should.
Commodity.
It's a commodity.
Yeah. Well, it's a business. Big business.
There's also in the news.
Oh yes,
the price of meat and permit me to throw in a little turn of phrase. It is a political hot potato. Speaking of a food analogy,
this has been going on for a while. So there was a big press conference, which included the president and Secretary Vilsack, and actually also Merrick Garland, the head of the Justice Department, had this announcement for all the farmers. And Biden, quote, "You have a partner in the White House," is what he told the farmers.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. He could tell them how
Yeah, most of whom apparently did not vote for him.
Okay.
However, it's okay. We all eat and we all need the farmers, and it's good if the White House is partnering with the farmers. And what the announcement was I think it was a week ago already, they released the news that they are going to the USDA is going to pony up $1 billion to help beef up and diversify the meat processing industry.
Well, I thought the meat processing industry was huge and getting along just fine.
Yeah, well, the problem is 85% of the processing in this country, that's a huge amount, is controlled by, I don't know, you know, four or five big companies, some of whom are owned by the Chinese and some by the Brazilian. It's very, very much, you know, and during the pandemic, you know, that's when the previous administration declared that meat processors were, whatever that phrase is, nationally necessary, you know, so they could not close down.
National treasures? No,
yeah,
that's artists.
I don't know. Yeah, there's some legal terminology that was, and so, of course, we talked a lot about that on the show, how the meat packing industries and the communities surrounding them, of which there are multiple ones in Iowa, were hardest hit by COVID. And actually, even right now, some of the OSHA, you know, the workforce health and safety regulations are, I think they're in front of the Supreme Court.
Ooh.
You know, can the president actually mandate masks and things like that in OSHA, or is that overstepping the presidential bounds, yada, wada, wada. So, this $1 billion, it sounds, I mean, why not, you know, but the press coverage has basically said, you know, it's kind of a drop in the bucket thing. There are some good things in it.
So where does this $1 billion go?
Well, in a future show, we'll actually have Ty Gustafson, our local Story City locker, on to talk about that. But they want to build. We obviously need more small meat processors because what happened to farmers in Iowa, we know plenty of them, when the packing houses, the big ones, you know, had all these problems, then all of a sudden the pigs are ready to go to market. What are we going to do with them? And even our local, you know, like if you buy meat locally from a farmer, that farmer has, they can't butcher that themselves. They can grow the cow or the pig, but they can't, I mean, that's, you can't butcher it yourself and then sell it to people. It's basically against the law. So all of them have to schedule to take the cow or the pigs into the locker. And like Cindy Madsen, for example, with her pork and her beef, was saying, I'm having to schedule a year out in advance to get to a local, you know, small or mid-sized processor in Iowa. So obviously to have either, you know, like is somebody like Ty Gustafson at Story City Locker, is he going to make his business bigger, or are there going to be more whole new businesses? Some of the money is actually going towards training the workers.
It sounds like a skill that more than a few people ought to know how to do if we're going to continue to eat meat.
Yeah, and especially at smaller work processing plants that are less automated, a higher skill level is required. And this is probably a good thing. Those are usually, you know, reasonably well-paying jobs in Iowa. So to put more money into that, they're also, part of it is they're doing things there. Okay, there's a whole thing about state or federal inspection.
Yeah.
Okay, now, most of the large blah, blah, blahs, of course, have federal inspection. Now, it used to be that federal inspection was significantly more rigorous than state inspection. This is, has to do with how was the animal killed, you know, its safety, cleanliness, hygiene issues, da-da-da-da-da. And the rule is, if the meatpacking plant is federally inspected, it has to have, at the time of the kill, a federal inspector on the floor. Now, the federal inspector has to be paid by the meatpacking processing company. Huh. So it's an expense for the meatpackers, and a rather hefty one. So they're jiggering around the laws to make that a little less difficult, and they're, you know, state inspection. I mean, this goes on, each state is different, but overall, the level of state inspection has improved greatly, and oftentimes the two are the same. But what it means for the person having the animal, you know, processed, which includes not only killing it, but, you know, cutting it up and packaging it. Do you want it in hamburgers? Do you want it in roasts? Do you want to make sausages out of it? Da, 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 da. All of this is done in the processing plant. So if you have this done in a state-inspected facility, you cannot sell it across state lines.
Huh.
Now, in the middle of Iowa, like we are, we're not really that near any state lines. So for most of the farmers in our neighborhood, perhaps that doesn't matter.
However, there are a lot of people that are doing direct marketing and they mailing specialty meats
right,
is kind of an important thing.
You can't do that without a federal inspection. And if you live in a part of the state that is like, say, near the Minnesota line or near the Nebraska line or whatever, a lot of those people market, like if you're in Western Iowa, you might be marketing into Omaha, which means if you're slaughtering in Iowa, you have to have a federally inspected plant, or you cannot sell across the state line. So they're working to change some of that and make it a little bit, you know, less expensive or funded differently. Those things are probably a real good idea. What is maybe less, you know, I've read some commentators who are saying, well, you know, first of all, processing, setting up a processing plant is a rather expensive thing. You know, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, it's not, you can set up a business for $50,000. No, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the market is volatile. Uh-huh. You know, what the concern is that people are going to be over leveraged because of the loans that they're getting from this, or they will be encouraged to start up a business that they're really not ready for, and there'll be the boom from the $1 billion injected, and then there'll be the bust. Mm. So, you know, as usual, there's some concern that at the federal level, maybe this wasn't completely thought out. Now, the interesting thing during the presentation was that Merrick Garland was part of the presentation.
Oh, what does he know about meat
processing? Trust busting. Oh, now, that, in my opinion, could be a really important element. Now, if you think back and you remember during the Obama administration, there, which was the same Secretary of Agriculture, right? There were listening sessions, and there was one, I think, in Ankeny, and the listening sessions were about processing and the stock, what's it called? The packer and stockyard legislation, blah, 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 blah. But the idea is basically the farmers are getting squeezed, and who's making all of the money, and the consolidation in the industry. When you have 85% of the processing in, say, five large international corporations, there's been legal settlements with price fixing, you know, the grocery stores are charging more money because they're paying more to the processors, but the farmers are not getting any more money. So who's making all the money? The processors. So they're hopefully, and they didn't do very well during the Obama administration. They made a lot of noise about listening to the farmers and what are the issues and what can we do about it. And then what happened? Nothing. Nothing, 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 right? So to have Merrick Garland show up means, we'll see what it means.
Right.
It means that because it's the Justice Department that has to take on the trust busting and kind of maybe break up some of these larger corporations, which, you know, historically has been a solution to some of these problems with monopolies. But it has not happened in this country for a long, long, long time. So that happened this week. Stay tuned. I mean, we do have the same Secretary of Agriculture that we had at the time. And I, you know, what did he do when he wasn't Secretary of Agriculture? Well, he worked for the largest dairy promotion industry in the country. Hello. So I, you know, I don't know. But obviously, President Biden is, listening to the inflation concerns of consumers, and that was his action last week. Okay, we're going to fix this, folks. So, but, you know, to do this at the federal level, it's going to take a while. So this will be an ongoing story. Stay tuned.
And it comes back down to the land and the farmers, and let's see how this plays out.
We'll give you the farmer's view on this in future stories.
And the meat packers, or the processing persons, because we do hope to have the Story City Lock people
we do.
With us.
And we'll also probably have another example of Paul Willis, from the founder of the Nyman Ranch Pork Company. We'll be on a show probably in February or March and talk about their model for dealing with some of this, too. So,
interesting.
We're working on it.
We are. This is KHOI, and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thank you, Donna, for keeping track of all this stuff that kind of makes my eyes glaze over. The labels.
I think I'm a food policy geek.
Food policy.
Sorry.
Somebody's got to do it.
I want to know what I'm eating here.
Okay.
And
thank
so
you.
Should we all, right?
Thank you. Well, I have a little recipe I would like to share with you. It is for Nigerian black-eyed pea fritters. We're going to get away from meat here altogether because this is a pulse-based thing. Black-eyed peas, I think. Or is black-eyed peas just a legume? It's one of those things. But anyway, black-eyed peas usually feature in a lot of New Year's celebrations because the idea of peas, beans, a lot of them in the pot, it sort of assures the prospect of bounty and good things happening in the new year. So black-eyed peas have long been an interesting, fun way to start the new year. I ran across this recipe in a book called Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African-American Cooking. It's nice to get new flavors into your repertoire. And this is the idea of using black-eyed peas as, it's pretty much that's all it is, and making fritters out of it.
It's very Southern.
Yeah, it's very Southern. The recipe comes from Nigeria, and their original, the name there would be called Akara, A-K-R-A, but we'll call it black-eyed peas fritters here. Actually, my husband made this, because he got this book for his birthday. So he likes to fool around with recipes. One nice thing, one important thing about this is that you do not even have to cook the black-eyed peas. You let them soak overnight. And because black-eyed peas actually absorb water pretty well, overnight soaking is really enough to make them soft enough.
So it softens them up. Then.
It does. It does. However, you soak the peas overnight, 1 pound of black-eyed peas, and then you drain them. Then you, if you, I don't know well, you have to do this, but he did this, and the recipe calls for that, is to get rid of some of the skins of the black-eyed peas. And he did that just by taking little handfuls of them and kind of rubbing them on a – just rubbing them so the hulls come off. You can kind of just throw those to the side. If you leave a few of the little paper hulls on, that's okay because you're going to put them into a food processor anyway. So you've got...
Oh, yeah. I expect you could also do that if you squish them in your hands in the water. The hulls rise up to the top and you
good
can
idea.
Drain them off.
That would be good. It just removes, yeah,
yeah,
removes
well,
some
yeah,
of
Yeah, and
skin.
Removing some of them would make it less... Well, less...
Toothsome?
more toothsome and less...
Yeah. It'd be good. It also says push it through a sieve, but that ended up being too messy. So we just kind of took them off. As needed, as they were, they kind of rolled off through his hands.
And then how did you smush them in the food processor?
Transfer the peas to a food processor.
I bet I know what would work well. You know, that conical thing that...
Oh.
The ricer. My mother used to call it the ricer.
And my mother used to call that the applesauce maker. Yeah.
Right.
The one with the,
or what you would use for potato ricing, too.
Yep.
Same thing.
It's about that. And really...
Hold the hulls back and let the... Yeah. Meat of it through. Yeah.
So you have this.
So you're making a meal out of it, basically.
Making a meal, yes. And then you add 1 cup minced onion, 1 tablespoon minced garlic, 1 teaspoon cayenne pepper and salt and pepper to taste, and throw that into the food processor. I kind of upped the cayenne. You could probably put some more tasty things in there, too. These were lovely, but they could have been spicier. But anyway.
Well, yeah, you could season that
any
however
way
you want.
Right. And then using peanut oil, which is a good idea because peanut oil you can...
Is light.
Is, and you can... it takes a hot... You can turn it up hot.
High heat.
High heat. And you deep fry them. And this was a first... So, this is a... taking the mashed up black-eyed peas, I used, and I bought myself this for Christmas, and I haven't used it for cookies, but the kind of little scoop, the little melon ball.
Oh, so it's a ball. You make it into a ball size.
You need to scoop that, because it is sort of wet. It's not something you do with your hands. And I just plop it in the hot oil, and cook it for 2 to 3 minutes on a side, and I thought they were pretty darn good, and the fact you didn't have to cook a pot of beans to start this with, I thought it was
Were they kind
good.
Of light and fluffy?
Yes, the insides were light and fluffy, and the outsides were all crunchy and good.
So maybe, do you think it's lighter than like a corn fritter, for example?
Yes, it was amazingly nice.
Oh.
And they also suggest you can do it with other beans if you'd like too, although you might have to cook some of the other beans first, but
Well, there was an article, so it says, in praise of pulse proteins. Pulse crops, a term that comes from pulls, P-U-L-S, the Latin word for porridge, are low-fat, edible, dry edible seeds. Think chickpeas, lentils, and dry peas. And within the larger categories of legumes, think soybeans and peanuts. And yellow peas have now become a new mainstay, like the basic feedstock for many of these new sort of plant-based meat-like patties.
That's right. Not meat.
Yes.
Beyond meat.
Right. What they're calling it, so in the U.S., retail sales for plant-based alternatives grew 27% in 2020, twice as fast as the overall sales. So, This makes an alternative for like a lot of Western crop growers. They grow like legumes. Lentils grow very well in Montana, for example. It says peas have become a staple ingredient for the plant-based meat industry in part because they are very, very cheap source of very, very high levels of protein nutrition. So it talks about there's a Montana farmer in here who's quoted as saying, I definitely see pulse protein and plant protein as part of the solution for feeding the growing crop population and to mitigate climate change. Here's why he says that. Because, first of all of these legumes fix nitrogen in the soil so you don't need to spray nitrogen fertilizer, right? And the other benefits it requires very little water. It improves the soil microbiome, the soil structure, and, of course, water retention. So it improves the yield and quality of the crop that follows in the rotation. So not only is it easier to grow the pulse crops, but the whatever comes after it, whether it's wheat in the west or corn here, it improves the soil enough to help the following crop. It also, because you're doing rotation, it prevents some crop diseases, and it can help farmers reduce or eliminate fallowing and tillage. So growing these peas and beans is a climate change solution.
And what's also very good about this,
and there's a market for it.
The
farmers can't grow it if they can't sell it. So hooray!
We have talked about this before. Market. Oh yeah, diversify crops. We say to the farmers, diversify. If they can't make any money this.
Yeah, not only does there have to be a market, but there has to be a way for the farmer to get it to the market. For example, there has to be an elevator or a buyer or some way to transport it to the middleman that sells it to the processors. So that means, you know, for example, if you're sitting on your, even if you have 1,000 acres and you're the only one around, can you grow enough to actually make it worthwhile getting to market? This is very tricky stuff. I mean, you have to be a genius to be a farmer, I have to say.
Yes, you do. And the idea of eating more plants is really a very good idea. I mean, I've ordered, and not just recently, I mean, a veggie burger every now and then, or a meatless couple days.
Yeah, and okay, you have to read the labels again when you do these things. Because I think that and this has been true for years for vegetarians. If you're eating a veggie burger that's made out of beans and grains, that's really, really healthy. And these are things your ancestors have eaten for thousands and thousands of years, beans and grains, right? But some of these new, more engineered proteins, like the real fake meat ones, the ones that bleed, that's a highly manipulated product.
We don't
have any proven history with eating those things. I'm still remain skeptical about that market. And also, I mean, there's been a lot of money invested in those things, particularly in Silicon Valley type startups, you know. But the thing is, I would stick to my black bean veggie burgers or something like that,
And this,
you can buy them. You can also make your own, for goodness sake.
Yes, you can. And the idea of taste good. Let's talk about the taste good thing. That's really important. And it does. And we have a few habits maybe we can address. The idea that we have to have meat for everything. I don't think so, folks.
Yes. 20 years ago, I was working a lot with an organization called Chefs Collaborative. And one of the first things that we did was we talked about the center of the plate, which means plop the big old steak. The big piece of protein is the center of the plate. And as chefs, we encouraged other chefs to make, you know, even if you're going to eat meat, you can certainly eat less meat. Like you can make a dish that has a stew, for example, that maybe has 35% vegetables, 25%, you know, peas or beans or pasta or something, and less meat, so that the meat is not the center of the plate. We all could eat less meat. That would be a healthy.
And we'll get along.
Especially as long as what we're eating is more vegetables. There is no such thing as too many vegetables.
Oh, thank you, Donna. That is words of wisdom.
That's a certainty, I have to say.
Good. Oh, I wonder, before going any farther, Donna, you and I recently watched a movie. Did you see Don't Look Up, the movie? See? Huh? I think everybody
quite talked about in the press. So this movie was it was the same director that did The Big Short, and I've enjoyed a lot of his movies before. They're very kind of sociologically political, and he has done in the past very good explanations for, like when he did The Big Short, it was about the financial meltdown of 2008. And he explained something very complicated, all the financial transactions, which, you know, we think GMO labeling is complicated and hidden from the public and obfuscated. Well, this financial maneuvering is, you know, way over the heads of most of us. So mm-hmm. in the film, The Big Short, he actually explained how that happened and what was going on. So this new movie, Don't Look Up, I mean, the premise of the story is that there's a comet hurtling at the planet that's coming at the beginning of the movie. It's coming in 6 months, and it is going to destroy the planet. And what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to give the spoilers. I mean, it's obviously a parable about global climate change, right?
Yes, it is. Right. It's about catastrophe.
And the way we handle it with the media and in politics, and it's definitely worth seeing.
It's worth seeing. And I wish to take my hat off to the power of satire, because I think we need it's a good thing to do. And
well, hey, Meryl Streep plays the president, and if you can imagine a female Meryl Streep version of our
former
president, it's worth going to see. It's very funny.
And just like a lot of good sci-fi and a lot of good novels and movies, it's not really about the future or about someplace else. It says a lot about us right now.
And it is not about Democrats or Republicans.
It's about us.
Both parties have a lot of stepping up to do on this issue.
So movie review. You get a little bit of everything.
Up, it's called.
You get a little bit of everything here on the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. For more information and recipes and archives and all kinds of things, go to khoifm.org. Welcome back. Just mentioned that we both enjoyed the movie Don't Look Up, but I've got to say I think we should all look up, although we can't see it. We had an amazing thing happen this last couple weeks, and people have been looking up and thinking about the stars and the universe. The James Webb Space Telescope went up. We haven't had one of those global worldwide events that people kind of can stop and say, oh.
Yeah, this is maybe, do you think it's as big as the first walk on the moon or something?
Actually, I think it costs about 10 times more.
Oh, it's
but,
big
no, no.
then. It's big.
Okay. It's been in the works since 2000. People have been starting to do this. It's the idea of getting a space telescope up there that takes over the Hubble telescope, which we've learned a lot from. But this thing, oh, it had so many wonderful science geeky things that you had to worry about because it went bigger and farther and it's going to see farther.
And it's all just for observation and data collection, right?
Yes.
They're not really colonizing or doing anything, right?
No.
Just learning.
And
observing.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. The thing costs, it says, $8.8 billion, huh? Including the design. And 5 to 10 years of operation, they don't quite know how long it will go, but they hope to learn a lot of things. It was launched on December 25th, 2021. And one thing that I think is amazing, not the fact, I mean, they folded it up and everybody was holding their breath and it unfolded on cue and, oh, was it good? The big mirrors are up there, the big gold fleck mirrors and the reflectors, and that all seemed to be working just fine and everything is, One thing is interesting is that where it is, the Hubble telescope is kind of swirling around. It goes around the Earth, okay? It's kind of up
so
there.
So it's in the Earth's orbit.
It's close. Okay. This thing, the James Webb Space Telescope, it is in orbit far from Earth to avoid heat radiation from the Earth and the Moon. Heat has a lot to do with this thing. You wouldn't think heat in space, but they're worried about that. So they had to find a shady space.
A place to put it.
A place to put it. There are places that scientists have found called Lagrange points.
Grange points?
L-A, Lagrange.
Lagrange points.
I've heard of this before. There's like L1, L2, L3. There's certain little sweet spots where you can put things up there. And this space telescope is headed for, maybe it's there already, in the L2 spot of the Sun-Earth system. It's a place of stable gravity, and it's kind of in the shadow of the Earth. It won't go around the Earth. It will move with the Earth around the Sun.
Staying in the shadow.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's the temperature thing, then.
L's before. It's supposed to be really interesting spots up there. My goodness. It is so neat that people can do that. If you got to spend my tax money, go ahead and do that. I can think of lots of other things that are a lot worse than looking into the heavens and finding out things that we just didn't even know we knew the questions for. So good luck to all of us.
Okay, you all have to know that Lana loves science fiction. And science fiction is a way of understanding science quite often. So,
well, it is.
You're good at this? I'm just like, when she told me about the way it unfolded, and I was like, oh, my goodness.
Isn't it neat? You just want to say, isn't that neat? And what a nice human thing to say. Oh, what a good thing. So, long fly the James Webb Space Telescope. And let's see what we can learn from this thing. I think, yeah, that's a good idea.
I think more observation of nature is always a good thing. Observation.
Yes. And so do look up. Let's look far and see exactly maybe.
Well, we won't be able to see this thing in the sky, though.
Oh, no, it's way out there, Donna.
Oh, okay,
I think we have to wait until it calls us back. Or something.
Oh, okay.
Send us pictures, or maybe it'll zoom. I don't know. It'll come back. I'm just so glad it's up there. And I just want to mention with this movie, they don't look up. I think we should look up and learn a few things. So there you go. Good. What are some other good things? Oh, here's some good news from the Donalana Kitchen News Department. There are. Despite everything happening here on the Earth, despite all of this COVID stuff, there have been new area restaurants opening.
Some brave souls.
Brave people.
Let me
and our
tell
hats
you.
Go off to. These are local restaurants that opened last year. Sweet Caroline's here in Ames.
It's right down. It's the former Old Main location.
Uh-huh. Ichiban, which is the new Japanese
restaurant on the south side of town, I think.
Nyland's Cafe over by Colo. Sweet Oaks, which is a bakery bistro in Collins. Jersey Mike's here in Ames.
Oh, where's that?
537 Lincoln Way.
Okay.
Subways. Sub sandwiches and things.
Oh, okay.
They bake their bread there, and they roast their own beef and all that kind of thing. And Cafe Noir, downtown Ames, a really fun.
That's right.
A nice place to have a nice drink. And Juniper and Olive Company in Jewel. And I think Donna and I have to make some road trips after the
right.
health
when,
situation.
When one is permitted to go,
yeah, there you go
safely to restaurants. And you know what? It's... The restaurant industry has been one of the hardest hit sectors like grocery stores are doing great sales because people are cooking at home more. So that means, well, if they're cooking at home, they're not eating in restaurants for obvious reasons. And it is there have been a lot of stories. Restaurants typically are a very low margin business with high failure rates. It's such a gamble to begin with, and then you add this COVID stuff on top.
So three cheers for those that are starting out something
brave,
new.
Very
we
brave.
Wish everyone the best. Yes. Some more from the Donalana Kitchen News Department. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick. That's our ticker tape. And it's always kind of ticking along. We pull things off. And I have to share this. I think this is a great news item. Wisconsin ice fisher people are rescued on Lake Michigan, where a couple dozen of them got stuck on an ice floe when they were ice fishing around Green Bay. You know, it's kind of that bay that goes down. But they ended up floating out onto...
Oh, the whole thing, they were just sitting there ice fishing and the whole thing
broke off.
And they... I saw that story. They were a mile out before they got them all rescued.
I hope they brought enough beer along with them. I don't know. It would scare me to death.
Well,
but anyway...
thank goodness it was in the middle. It was the daytime.
Daytime. And So here's all these guys standing on the ice floe and... I suppose there's a Coast Guard. There were a bunch of boats or whatever that, anyway.
Came and rescued them all.
Came and rescued them.
Right.
So
nobody was worse for the wear.
No.
But what an adventure. Oh, my goodness.
So be careful out there, folks.
Yeah, because we're getting a lot of, it's not as cold
freeze
as
thaw,
it's usually been.
Thaw.
We're getting a lot of freeze thaw. I did see a lot of skaters out on the Skunk River yesterday.
Well, that's not quite as deep as Lake Michigan.
No,
you might get a little wet there.
But it's going to be way above freezing for the next few days,
mm-hmm.
so it'll get sloshy.
Another quick little news item. We mentioned the former president. Well, we have the former first lady offering one of her hats for sale. You are free to bid on it. She went to an event, and there was this lovely white hat that only she could look good in, of course, big brim, lovely white hat. And she's offering to sell it as a fundraiser, only paid in cryptocurrency. The starting bid is $250,000.
In cryptocurrency.
That hat won't suit me at all. It just doesn't. I wouldn't wear that sort of hat. But if you are interested in a hat for Easter, there you have it. Very good. And closer to home, I want to mention that the Ames Main Street Farmers Market, believe it or not, is still going strong. Now, granted, there's not a lot of the summer vegetables and things for sale, and flowers are kind of done for the year, but they've been having monthly events. Winter Farmers Market.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one is this coming Saturday, January 15th, from 9 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock. At 500 Main Street, downtown Ames, you might remember that as the site of the old drug town right there on the corner. It's a nice big space. People can set things up in there.
And what kind of things are still available?
Oh, goodness.
Because you went the last time, right?
Yeah, there was a Christmassy market last time. I went to the Christmassy market. It was fun. So still for sale all around, and you can go there to purchase meats. Cheese, mushrooms. I think Aaron Johnson and his Joy Girl mushrooms are still doing
right,
quite
and,
well.
And the cheese is Kevin Diesel's.
I think so. Yeah,
cheese
uh-huh. and jams
really good.
And jams and jellies. Lots of honey. Do buy local honey. It's good for you. Baked goods. Never enough of that. And a lot of Freddy's handcrafted items. And these are local producers. We like local producers. Yes, we do. So that's this weekend.
Saturday morning.
9 to 1. You are listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We had music today by Sam Bartlett. Thanks for your support of this fine radio station. Stay warm. Be kind. And check the ice before you go fishing.
Or skating.
Be careful.
Or skiing.
There. Yeah. Ooh.
We've had some cross-country skiing down the rivers because there's no snow.
Be careful. Yeah. Enjoy winter. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
You've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.